Hello, and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. On previous episodes of this program, we've heard a lot about how, in the past, Alaska and Russia helped to melt the ice curtain. That was an important time in U.S. and Russian relations. Things are a little different today, though, and this program asks the question, are we headed back to the cold? Our speaker for today is former ambassador to the Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, who also served as special assistant to the president and senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council and took place at 49th State Brewing Company on March 30th.
Well, first of all, Lisa, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thank you to the Alaska World Affairs Council for hosting me today. I've been asked to talk about U.S.-Russia relations, are we headed back to the cold? And what I will do is I'll break my talk down into five parts. First of all, a little bit of history, recent history. Second, I'll talk about what drives Russia's policy. What's the Kremlin trying to achieve? Because we need to understand that if we're going to have a smart policy to deal with Russia. Third, I'll talk a bit about the first 15 months of the Trump administration's policy towards Russia. Fourth, you know, are we back in a Cold War? And then fifth, some ideas I would have for a more effective policy to deal with the Russian challenge. But let me just, for context, begin with the observation that when I look out over the next 25 years, and I look at the big strategic challenge to the United States, it's not Russia, it's China. I mean, China will be the big political, economic, military superpower of the future. But Russia still matters, and it matters a lot because it remains the only country in the world that in a matter of hours could physically destroy the United States. So we have to deal with Russia, and we have to think of ways to deal with them in an effective manner. Now, in one sense, the hostility, the tension between the United States and Russia is not easy to understand. The sorts of things that traditionally lead to conflict between two countries are not really present between the United States and Russia. So for example, we do not have territorial disputes. There are some outliers in Moscow who would like to revisit a certain czarist trade deal or sale back in 1867, but aside from that, there are no territorial disputes between the two countries. Second, we don't have disputes over resources. Both countries are richly endowed with natural resources, so that competition's not there. But still, you have a relationship that you've seen over the last 27 years in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union that has been one of ups and downs. One of my colleagues at Brookings, also a professor at Georgetown, Angela Stent, wrote a book about 2 years ago called The Limits of Partnership. And she came up with a very interesting observation, is that if you look at the Bill Clinton administration, the George W. Bush administration, the Barack Obama administration, each of those presidents came to the office with the desire to work to build a better relationship between the United States and Russia. And in the case of the Clinton administration, I can attest to that. I spent 3 years on the National Security Council under President Clinton. And what Dr. Stent observes is that in the first term, the first Clinton term, the first Bush term, the first Obama term, in fact, you saw very positive developments in U.S.-Russia relations. But those developments were not sustainable. And in the second term, the relationship deteriorated. And I think in each case, each of those presidents left office, you know, feeling that they'd not achieved as much as they might have in terms of bettering the relationship with Moscow. And let me just offer a couple of observations on the Obama administration. When the Obama administration came to office in 2008, it was a low point in U.S.-Russia relations. You had Russian unhappiness about NATO enlargement, about American missile defense in Europe. There'd just been the conflict between Russia and Georgia. And the Obama administration launched the reset. And the way that they would explain it was, look, there are things that we think the Russians can do on issues that matter to the president's policy that would make it easier to advance goals. And so we're going to try to reset things and see if Russia can be a more helpful country. Now, it's important to remember in 2009, when Mr. Obama took office, his opposite number in the Kremlin was not Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin had stepped down as president to become prime minister, and his prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, had become president. And there was a certain chemistry between Obama and Medvedev. I mean, they were both similar backgrounds, both lawyers, similar ages, and that may have enabled some things that would have been more difficult to do had Mr. Putin still been president. Now, having said that, I think that there was also a very clear understanding who was calling the shots in Moscow. Embassy Moscow once famously sent in a cable that said, Dmitry Medvedev is Robin to Vladimir Putin's Batman. And so while Medvedev was president, I think real authority still rested with Putin. But in the first year and a half of the Obama administration, in fact, the reset delivered some important things. So by the fall of 2010, you'd had the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty. Those limits just kicked in fully about a month ago, and you now have U.S. and Russian strategic forces at their lowest levels since the 1960s. Missile defense, which had always been a very contentious issue, there seemed to be a different discussion about missile defense and even the possibility of NATO, Russian, American cooperation on missile defense. On Afghanistan, Afghanistan had always been a problem because there were significant numbers of NATO and American troops in Afghanistan. And in 2008, the only way to supply them was through Pakistan. And any time that there was a hiccup in U.S. relations with Pakistan, what you had was that flow of supplies to Afghanistan got turned off. Well, in 2010, the Russians are allowing lethal equipment to transition through Russian territory and allowing American supplies to fly directly over Russian airspace into Afghanistan. And on Iran, you had more help. And that in the summer of 2010, the Russians agreed to an arms embargo on Iran at a time when Iran was one of the major purchasers of Russian weapons. But what happened is, as with the previous three administrations, those early gains from the reset were not sustainable. So no further progress on arms control after 2011. And you have Vladimir Putin comes back to the presidency in 2011. And he comes back with something of a chip on his shoulder, a sense of grievance. And so in 2012, 2013, when you talk to people in the administration, their hope is to sort of keep the U.S.-Russia relationship going, but no expectations of major progress. And then 2014 happens. You have the Ukraine crisis. Following Mr. Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, he flees Kyiv after government forces open fire and kill about 100 demonstrators on the streets of Kyiv. A week later, he turns up in Russia. But the Ukrainian parliament appoints an acting president and an acting prime minister who make very clear that their number one foreign policy goal is to bring Ukraine closer to the European Union. And about 3 days later, little green men, that's the Ukrainian term, begin to take control of Crimea. Little green men, they are clearly professional soldiers by the way they handle themselves and their weapons. They're wearing Russian combat fatigues, but they carry no identifying insignia. Asked about this at a press conference about 6 days later, Putin says, no, they're not Russian troops. They're just local defense guys. About a month later, he does admit that, in fact, they were Russian troops. What you have then is the seizure of Crimea, followed by its illegal annexation. And then a couple weeks later, you have the appearance in eastern Ukraine of more little green men. That triggers a conflict that's now gone for over 4 years and has resulted in more than 10,000 dead. And that really began to plunge the U.S.-Russia relationship to a new low, followed by what we saw in 2016, Russia's interference in the U.S. presidential election. So that's where things were at the end of 2016, the U.S.-Russia relationship already at a difficult place. First of all, what does drive Kremlin policy is the normal natural interests that drive a country. One thing I believe does not drive Mr. Putin's policy, I don't believe he's trying to recreate the Soviet Union. And that's because they recognize that rebuilding the Soviet Union would require that the Russian economy subsidize all the other republics. And Russia is not prepared to do that. But what Mr. Putin wants is a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. He wants countries such as Ukraine, Georgia, countries like Kazakhstan and Central Asia to defer to Moscow on issues that the Russians define as central to Russian interests. And that includes things like how close you get to institutions such as NATO and the European Union. But it's also important to remember that for the Kremlin, the number one job is regime preservation. And so domestic politics in Russia explain a lot about Russian foreign policy. And let me give an example. From 2000 to 2008, the first two terms when Vladimir Putin was president, when you talk to Russians, they would say, Mr. Putin has an informal social contract with us, in which he says, we Russians, we're not going to have much of a political say, but we will have a growing economy, we will see our living standards rise. And Mr. Putin was lucky. He came to office in 2000, and about a year later, the price of oil went up. If you ever look at a graph that shows the price of oil and overlay that against a graph that shows the performance of the Russian economy, they match almost to a T. And so Putin could justify regime legitimacy on economics because the economy was growing 6 or 7% a year, living standards are growing, the middle class in Russia was growing. Now, when he came back to the presidency in 2012, the economic situation was much more grim, and he didn't talk about economics. He talked about Russian nationalism. He talked about rebuilding Russia as a great power, and a big part of that was a fairly strong anti-American element. And unfortunately, we saw that repeat in the Russian political campaign, such as it was, which culminated in the presidential election just a couple of weeks ago in Russia. For example, the Russian president typically gives his State of the Union speech in December. This year, they moved it to March 1st. Not a coincidence, it was 17 days before the Russian presidential election. And in an hour and a half speech, Mr. Putin devotes about a third of that to talking about the American and NATO military threat and talking about a huge array of new nuclear weapons that will defend Mother Russia. And again, I think what we're seeing there is he's not able to talk about an economic situation that offers much prospect. So instead, he's portrayed and hyped the American threat and then portrayed himself as the defender of Russia. And that plays well with his constituency at home. Now, also, we need to bear in mind that Mr. Putin has a sense of grievance. He looks at what's happened in the last 25, 30 years and says, the West took advantage of Russian weakness. For example, NATO enlargement was designed not to respond to requests from countries like Poland that had emerged from the wreckage of the Warsaw Pact and join NATO, but it was designed to hem in Russia to bring military force to Russia's borders. Now, again, I worked for President Clinton for 3 years in the 1990s, and that certainly was not Bill Clinton's goal. But I think Vladimir Putin has this very different perception. Likewise, he looks at the so-called color revolutions, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004, the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine in 2014, the Rose Revolution in 2003 in Georgia, and he doesn't look at those as manifestations of popular discontent with stolen elections or growing authoritarianism. He sees those as orchestrated by Western special services. And that he says that so much, I have to think at one level he does believe it. And that's a problem for us, because I think those perceptions are completely wrong. And in the question and answer session, we can talk about that. But I don't know how he changed his perception. So he somehow sees himself really as fighting a domestic or a defensive struggle against the West. Let me just make a couple of other comments about Russia. One is, Vladimir Putin is the most powerful person in the Kremlin since Joseph Stalin. And he does not have some of the constraints that Soviet leaders from Stalin's death up until 1991 had. There's no Politburo. I mean, the Politburo was powerful enough in 1964 to fire Nikita Khrushchev when they thought he was going in the wrong direction. There's no group like that within the Kremlin that provides checks and balances on Mr. Putin. Another question we have to face is, how long will we deal with him? If Mr. Putin chooses to observe the Russian Constitution, in 2024, when this term is up, he'll have to step down, because the Constitution says you can only do two terms in a row. Obviously, seeing what the Chinese president has done by changing the Chinese Constitution, the question is, would Mr. Putin do something similar? But even if he does step down, I think we also have to, for planning purposes, assume that when Mr. Putin goes, and this will be a process which will be very opaque for us. One of the things, a senior American official who came back from Russia about a year ago said, it's harder to understand what goes on in the Kremlin today than it was back during Soviet times. In Soviet times, at least, you had the Great October Revolution Day parade, when the Politburo lined up on the top of Lenin's mausoleum, and you could say, oh, that person's two more people closer to the center, he's on the upswing. It's harder now to understand, but there may be something of a secession struggle that we can't see. My guess is that the person who emerges from that struggle is going to look a lot more like Vladimir Putin than like Mikhail Gorbachev. A second observation I would make about Russia that we should bear in mind for the long term is that Russia is a state in decline. Its demographics are horrible. There will be many fewer Russians in 2050 than there are today. It has a stagnant economy. The economy contracted in 2015 and 2016. Last year, it grew at an anemic rate of about 1.5%. And most analysts project very slow growth looking out. And it doesn't make much that the world wants to buy. I mean, let me ask here, does anybody in the room here own a car, a computer, a television, clothes, furniture made in Russia? I didn't think so. What Russia makes that the world wants to buy are weapons. But other than that, if you look at the Russian export structure, it's oil, gas, timber, gold, its commodities. It's not an economy that's set to succeed in the 21st century. And I think Dmitry Medvedev, as president, I think he understood it. I'm not sure that Vladimir Putin does understand that. Example I would cite, 10 years ago, Mr. Medvedev started a project at Skolkovo. This is a suburb of Moscow. And he said, this is going to be our Silicon Valley. And we're going to compete with the Americans and show that we can do it. And 10 years from now, my guess is most of you have never heard of Skolkovo. It did not fail because the Russians don't have smart people. There are about 15,000 Russian emigres working today in Silicon Valley. It failed because they didn't build the infrastructure around it that makes Silicon Valley a success. The legal infrastructure, contract enforcement, patent protection, the financial infrastructure, venture capitalists will say, that's a great idea. Here's $25 million. Go build the next Google. And I don't think Russia is going to be able to build that infrastructure because that requires loosening up on the political reins in a way that appears to make the Kremlin very uncomfortable. So I think 20 years from now, we may be worrying about a weak Russia, but in the near term, it's still a country that can pose some challenges.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. Former Ambassador to Ukraine Stephen Pfeiffer is the speaker today. He continues with his analysis of the Trump administration's actions so far.
So let me talk a little bit about what we've seen in terms of the Trump administration's policy over the last 15 months. And it's been kind of a surprise. I know my friends in Ukraine were very worried when Mr. Trump was elected because some of the things he'd said. He'd suggested he might recognize the illegal annexation of Crimea by Russia. And he talked about wanting a better relationship with Russia. Now, at one level, I agree. I spent probably half of my career in the Foreign Service working to try to get to better relations between the United States and Russia, or the United States and the Soviet Union. But I don't see how we get there without Russia correcting some of its misbehavior. And it's not clear to me that the president has made that connection. What's been interesting, though, is that if you look at policy over the last 15 months, and I think this reflects advice that the president got from people like the former National Security Advisor, General McMaster, people like Secretary Mattis, it's actually pretty much a mainstream Republican foreign policy. It's supportive of NATO, supportive of Ukraine, very skeptical about Russia, and reinforced by congressional skepticism about Russia, and in some ways is a continuation of the hardening that you saw in the Obama administration in the last couple of years. And I find that interesting because it's not one would have predicted back in November or December of 2016. But I also think it's not clear to me that the president fully supports that policy. Certainly statements, for example, calling and congratulating President Putin on his election a week ago are not where his administration is going. And I think that's kind of a question mark that hangs over the policy. Part of this problem, of course, is the continuing question of investigations, both congressional and by Mr. Mueller, on what contacts that there might have been between people on the Trump campaign and Russians. And I don't purport to understand that very well. I think, you know, there seems to be a lot of smoke, and I think it's an investigation that needs to conclude. I would also say, though, that this is not about the legitimacy of the 2016 election. you can't prove that person X voted for President Trump as opposed to Hillary Clinton because of the leak of the DNC emails. So I would separate that out, but I still think that this is also what the Russians did was an egregious violation of the rules. I mean, this was a Russian attack on the political system, and my concern is that if we don't come up with a better response, we're going to see Russian interference in our elections in 2018 and 2020 and continuing. Let me talk for a moment about whether or not we're going back to a Cold War. And certainly when you look at the agenda between Washington and Moscow, there are a lot of difficult issues. Former Secretary Tillerson said, Ukraine is the biggest obstacle to getting back to a more normal U.S.-Russia relationship. Will there be progress on that? Differences over Syria. Syria is a really kind of an interesting situation where you have both Russian and American military forces operating in the skies and on the ground in Syria. And what they have been able to do is establish what they call a deconfliction channel. So there's regular communications between American and Russian military personnel, basically to make sure that our planes stay out of each other's way. There's a really interesting incident about 6 weeks ago where there was an American position where Americans were on the ground with a Syrian opposition group. They were approached by an opposing force. The Americans talked to the Russians and said, do you know anything about this force? The Russians said, this aren't our guys. And the force got into a place where it looked threatening and came under a fairly severe air attack by U.S. airplanes. What came out from the Russian media about 3 or 4 days later was, it turns out there was a fairly significant number of Russians in that group. Not Russian soldiers, but Russian mercenaries. And at least the Russian government has now said at least 8 Russians were killed. Some Russian sources are saying as many as dozens or hundreds of Russians were killed. And the interesting thing, which I still haven't figured out what it means analytically, is Moscow has not made that an issue. When I've talked to Russians in the last few weeks and I've said, what I hear from the American press and the Defense Department has said, we talked to the Russian military before we hit that group. And what the Russians tell me is, yes, that's the press line in Russia too, is yes, the Americans talked to us. There's an interesting story there that I don't think we fully understand, but it does show, I think, the risk where you could have direct conflict between Americans and Russians that we have to worry about. Another concern I have is the potential fate or the fate of the nuclear arms control regime, where I believe nuclear arms control makes sense between Washington and Moscow because we want to bound that part of the competition. But the 1987 Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Missiles has been violated by Russia. And the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, although it's now fully in force, expires by its terms in less than 3 years. And there is a possibility that we might lose both the INF Treaty and that the new START Treaty expires, which would mean that then for the first time in 50 years, there are no constraints between Washington and Moscow governing their nuclear forces. And I worry about that because it seems to me that that means losing not only the limits, but we also lose the predictability we get from agreements that require data exchanges and allow inspections and notifications. And we may be headed for a world that's less predictable, less stable, and less secure. But, so I think the situation is bad. It's by far the worst situation we've had in U.S.-Russian relations since the end of the Soviet Union. And I would say it's a Cold War, but it's not like the first Cold War. There are big differences. And there are differences, I think, that advantage the United States this time around. First of all, the first Cold War in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s was between the United States and NATO and the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. Well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. It's just Russia. And the Warsaw Pact disbanded 25 years ago, and in fact, most of the members of the Warsaw Pact now belong to NATO. One big change. For most of the Cold War, we worried that the Russians or the Soviets had significant numerical advantages in conventional forces. That's changed. Economics, if you take the American economy and the European economy and combine them, you're talking about an economy that's about 20 times the size of the Russian economy. So the economic competition is not going to be very difficult. And finally, there's really not much of an ideological struggle. With the end of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Communist Party, there's no longer this communist ideology out there to challenge the West. And that's really game over. But the Russian challenge today is different. And Russia is using different tools, tools that we did not see during the Cold War. It's what somehow sometimes described as a hybrid conflict. Its use of social media, its use of cyber techniques to probe American infrastructure and perhaps develop ways to attack American infrastructure. And it's other steps that I think go beyond what the West thought were sort of the rules of the game. And the most recent example we've seen in the last 3 weeks is the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Britain. It seems to me that this was most logically conducted by Russian security services, who take a very dim view of traitors. There has been a series of other mysterious deaths by Russians in Britain. And it triggered what to me was actually a quite remarkable on Monday, was 30 countries expelled 150 Russian diplomats. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that. And that kind of decision by that many countries probably surprised Moscow. I don't think they expected that reaction. But it's a reflection, to my mind, that many countries in the West have now said, Russia is going beyond the rules. One of the rules is you don't have a right to go and assassinate people on the territory of other countries. You don't have a right to use military force to take territory from neighboring countries, as the Russians did with Crimea. And this has now culminated where you now have, I think, a significant pushback against the Russians. So let me just conclude my talk by talking a bit about what I think we might do to have a more effective American policy with Russia. And it's going to be a combination of two things. We're going to have to find ways where we can push back against Russia when Russia oversteps, but we've also got to look for ways to have channels of communications. It's going to be a balance of pushing back and engagement. Now, the engagement's not going to be easy. It's going to have to start with small steps. But are there things that we can do to begin to take some of the edge off of the competition? And I'm not talking about going back to business as usual, but for example, things like arms control make sense, because when you have tensions, you want to control that aspect of the competition. I would like to see Secretary Mattis and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Dunsford meet on a more regular basis with the Russian counterparts. So for example, today, and you experienced this up in Alaska, you have many more visits by Russian military aircraft into the Alaskan Air Defense Zone than was the case, say, 5 or 7 years ago. And there are many more instances now where you have American and Russian military aircraft operating in close proximity than was the case 5 years ago. You have Russian airplanes buzzing American ships in the Black Sea, and there's always the potential there for accident or miscalculation. It would be good to have the military types get together and define some rules of the road so you reduce that risk. We don't want to have a situation that escalates because the sides misinterpret what the other is doing. And there's a lot of good antecedents we have to this. In 1989, between the United States and the Soviet Union, we had an agreement on the prevention of dangerous military incidents. And it basically were a set of rules for how U.S. and Soviet forces along the inner German border would act. And it had logical things saying, you don't point a targeting laser at forces on the other side of the border. Here's a radio communications channel. If you see something across the border by a Soviet unit that you don't understand, call them and ask them. And then the idea was to make greater transparency, reduce the risk of miscalculation or surprise. And I think that would be very useful at this point in time. There are other areas where cooperation still with Russia makes sense. Cooperation in trying to contain and reduce North Korea's nuclear program. Neither the United States nor Russia has an interest in seeing North Korea's nuclear potential grow. As I said, I think on the arms control, the sides have an interest in containing that element of their competition. But these are going to require dealing with some tough issues. So one question they have to deal with, the Russian violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. That was signed by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in 1987, and it prohibits all U.S. and Russian land-based missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. Russia's now deployed a missile in violation of that agreement. Last December, the Trump administration announced a set of political, economic, and military steps that were designed to encourage Russia to come back into compliance with the treaty. That should be the goal. I'm not sure that we've come up with sufficiently strong measures, but that's going to be a big issue. If the INF treaty collapses, my guess is it will have a very negative effect on arms control in general, and probably also have a negative impact on the New START treaty. A second area is, how do we manage differences over Ukraine? And it looks to me like the Kremlin is quite content with this simmering conflict in eastern Ukraine as a means to put pressure on and destabilize the Ukrainian government. I'd like to think I'm wrong on that, that the Russians actually would like to find a way out of the quagmire. But in the last 4 years, I've seen very little to suggest that the Russians want to have a solution. Now, there's been talk in the last few months about an international peacekeeping force. And if that kind of force was properly designed, it might help provide an answer. But I don't think we've yet seen a clear signal from Moscow whether that would be an acceptable path to begin to resolve that problem. And I think as long as Ukraine is going to be an issue, it's going to be hard to get back to a more normal relationship between the West and Russia, because this has been the most blatant use of military force since World War II, by which one state has taken territory from another, a big violation of the rules of the European game. Syria is going to be an area of continued differences, in part because we differ on the fate of the Syrian President Assad. Russia wants to keep him in power. I think most in the United States and the American-led coalition see Assad as really the problem. I'm not sure if we can be able to bridge that difference. And looking forward, I think it's going to make some sense for the United States to draw some more red lines with Russia. And I don't see a red line as a threat, but it's really part of deterrence. Making clear to the Russians that if you do this, the costs are going to be far greater than the benefits you might hope to achieve. And helping to avoid Russia from taking steps that would provoke an American reaction that they don't want. And I'll just give three examples of. One is, it's going to be important for the United States to continue to signal its commitment to NATO's military presence in the Baltic region, where in the last 2 years, NATO has now deployed small contingents of forces in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. Those forces are about 1,200 troops in each country. They're not an offensive threat, but what they do serve is as a tripwire. They make very clear, if there was ever a consideration in the Kremlin, to military action against the Baltic states. And let me say, I think that's a really tiny possibility. But if I was here 5 years ago, I would have said that's a zero possibility. So it's moving in the wrong direction. The trend is not good. But the presence of those forces in the Baltic states makes clear to the Russians that any military action means Russian troops are fighting not just Estonians and Latvians, but they're fighting Americans, Germans, British, Italians, and Canadians. And I think that's the kind of thing that we want that line to be very clear, very bright, and very red, because we don't want the Russians to make a miscalculation there. And if we do it right, the Russians won't miscalculate. A second red line I think we need to do is on the question of nuclear weapons, because one of the things that I find disturbing about the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin is he talks about nuclear weapons in a way that we can't remember Russian or Soviet leaders talking about in 30 or 40 years. And there is concern, is Russia moving towards a situation where they might lower the nuclear threshold in a possible conflict, consider early use of nuclear weapons? Now, I'm not sure whether Russian policy reflects that. I've had lots of discussions with the Russians in the last few years, and they say, no, you don't understand our doctrine. We're not going that way. And there are even some American analysts who say, yeah, the Russian doctrine is not going that way. But if you read the nuclear posture review that the Pentagon released in February, the Pentagon believes the Russians have gone in that way. And I worry that there's a possible misunderstanding, or that the Russians may not correctly understand how we would respond to nuclear use. And so I think it would be very important to signal the Russians that, look, a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. It doesn't matter if it's a small nuclear weapon. It doesn't matter if it's a tactical nuclear weapon. If you've used it, you've crossed a line that has not been breached in 70 years. And the rules of the game then change completely. And the consequences, you've opened a Pandora's box. The consequences are unpredictable and potentially catastrophic. We do not want the Red Kremlin to make any kind of miscalculation in that area. And then a third red line would be on Ukraine. It is basically reinforcing a line that I think that is there to the Russians, that any new major Russian separatist military offensive against Ukraine would generate consequences. And I'm not talking about sending the American military there, but additional economic sanctions on Russia, provision of more weapons to the Ukrainian military, because we don't want the Russians to miscalculate. Now, in each of those cases, I would match the pushback, I would match the red line also with an offer of dialogue. So on the case of NATO and the Baltic states, It seems to me important to get a dialogue going between NATO and Russia. Can you use confidence-building measures, transparency measures, to reduce tensions? Is there a possibility to get to a dialogue that might even lead to some arms control arrangements that would further calm the tensions there? Basically signaling to the Russians that, you know, we would like to find a way to get to a better position, but there also needs to be protection for American allies. On the question of nuclear weapons, we had one round of strategic stability talks last year. I think that this should be a continuing process. We should talk about our nuclear concerns, Russian missile defense concerns. What's cyber mean? I think cyber has implications. How do we deal with the cyber and the potential military uses of cyber techniques? Now, those discussions might not lead immediately to agreements or dialogue, but there's a utility in having a conversation in where each side gets to hear the other's concerns and maybe be able to explain things in a way that reduces those concerns. And then on the case of Ukraine, my position would be to signal the Russians that, look, if you are prepared to implement the peace arrangements that were worked out 3 years ago and get out of eastern Ukraine, that does open up the path to a more normal U.S.-Russia relationship. Now, this is going to be a complex policy. It means pushing back and drawing red lines on one hand, but also reaching out to engage the Russians on the other. And I think it's sometimes this is not easy for American diplomacy because we're much more comfortable categorizing countries as friends or enemies. And this is going to be a country that has adopted an adversarial approach, but there are still areas where engagement makes sense for our interests. And if there's a convergence of interests where we ought to be able to work together. I would offer one bit of optimism, is that if you looked at the situation in 1984 or 2008, where you had a real low point in relations between Washington and Moscow, things changed very quickly for the positive. I'm not expecting that now, but I also would not rule it out. But in the meantime, I think we have to pursue a policy that's going to be complex. It's going to require being very clear-eyed about Russia and Russian objectives. It's going to require that we be persistent and we be patient, and we make progress where we can. We manage differences where we don't agree. But I also think that the red lines may offer some advantages, and the extent that we have those red lines, it may increase the prospects that down the road the dialogue can be more productive and more successful. And I guess my final observation is, when I look at what I would like to see in American policy, I'm not sure if the Trump administration yet has found that right balance between red lines and pushback and, you know, being ready to talk. And that finding that balance, again, that balance right, would lead to a more effective way to engage with the Russian challenge. And let me stop at that point and I'd be happy to take questions.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you are listening to Addressing Alaskans. On the program today, we are looking at whether we are headed back into the cold by examining current U.S. and Russian relations. We're hearing from former Senior Director of Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council, Stephen Pfeiffer. We return to him now as he answers questions from the audience.
Okay, so one of the best ways to explain Russian behavior is its lack of access to warm water ports, right? I think this really well explains its activity in Crimea. And also why NATO accepted Turkey in the first place. However, we've seen kind of in recent years a weird shift in alignment between Turkey and Russia, right? We have two events, assassination of a Russian ambassador in Turkey and the shooting down of a Russian plane by Turkish forces. Yet that hasn't seemed to kind of dissuade this realignment between Erdogan going up with Russia. So especially over the new disagreements between the U.S. and Kurdish armament. Mm-hmm. So do you think that the Kurdish issue would be, I guess, how do I say this, like a bargaining chip for the U.S. to bring Turkey back into the fold? Or would that ever be useful in constraining Russia, or old-time Cold War not, you know, not the same issue?
Yeah. No, I'm not sure if we could play the Kurdish chip with Turkey in a way that the U.S. government would feel comfortable doing. I think what you've had, the Turkish problem really goes back maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and to some extent, it's a feeling that they were rejected by Europe. And I am sympathetic to, in some extent, to the Turkish case on this, where the Turks feel that membership in the European Union is always on offer. It's always on offer, but it's never going to happen. And I think Erdogan then began to turn away from Europe in that way. And then you've also seen within Turkey, Erdogan move in a more authoritarian direction. You know, 10 years ago, people looked at Erdogan and said, this is the model for a modern Islamic state, where it can be an Islamic state, but it can also be a democratic state. Unfortunately, Erdogan's moved in the wrong direction on that. And I think you've also seen over the last 20 years in Russia, Putin move in a much more authoritarian direction. And I think that explains their ability to interact and their ability to really stop on a dime. You know, 2 years ago when the Turks shot down that Russian airplane, the relationship plunged. But again, you know, within a few months, Erdogan and Putin were able to patch it back up. And it is going to be an issue, I think, for NATO. I mean, there are questions now as, you know, Turkey is a key member of NATO. It has the, I think, largest land army of all of the NATO members, with the exception of the United States. You know, but how close is Turkey getting to Russia? They're talking about, for example, now buying Russian weapons. How do you integrate that with NATO? And I think there's some questions that need to be worked out that are going to be pretty difficult, but that probably have to be understood first and foremost in terms of differences between Europe and Turkey and the United States and Turkey. If we can get those right, you know, maybe then the Turkish-Russian relationship changes in a different way.
I understand that Russia has a naval fleet in Crimea, and knowing that, and knowing that the Ukraine was going towards Europe, yeah, it seems like that was a missed diplomatic opportunity there. Could you address that?
Well, let me say a couple comments about Crimea. First of all, Russia has a historical case for Crimea. It was Catherine the Great that colonized it. Sevastopol, which is the main city of Crimea and the main harbor, was founded to be the home port for the Russian Black Sea Fleet. And the Crimea is the only part of Ukraine where ethnic Russians were a majority. They were about 60% of the population. Now, having said all that, and acknowledging the Russian case, in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev transferred Crimea from the Russian Soviet Federal Soviet Republic to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, everybody agreed, including Russia, that we accept the current borders. And that decision was made wisely, in my view, because if you start redrawing the borders, where do you stop? Russia, in several agreements, including one that I helped negotiate in 1994, the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances, and that was a key piece of persuading Ukraine to give up, at the time, what was the world's third largest nuclear arsenal, and we were talking about 2,000 strategic nuclear weapons pointed at the United States. Ukraine gave those up in part because in the Budapest Memorandum, the United States, Russia, and Britain agreed to respect Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence, and agreed not to use force or even to threaten to use force against Ukraine. Russia's violated all of those provisions in the last several years. So my point is, Russia had a claim to Crimea, but in effect, in 1991, they accepted a different arrangement. Now, also I would argue that the two key Russian interests in Crimea were being met without Russia having to seize it. So Russia had a large naval force based in Sevastopol. About 20,000 Russian sailors and troops were in Crimea by agreement with Ukraine. Ukraine had not challenged that. And ethnic Russians in Crimea were not mistreated in any kind of way. In fact, at the local level, they largely ran things. So the sorts of concerns Russia might have expressed, I don't think were really real. And what I interpret this as, and it's to some extent supported by a documentary that Vladimir Putin took part in about 2015, where he talked about this. He says the decision to take Crimea was made, I think it was the night of February 22, 23. And that was one day after, in Kyiv, you'd had the appointment of an acting president, an acting prime minister, said, our foreign policy priority is to get closer to Europe. I think, in effect, Putin panicked at that, said, what can we do? And the military said, well, we have this plan, you know, to take Crimea. And as it turned out, there were also about 15,000 Ukrainian military forces on Crimea. Ukraine, for a variety of reasons, one of which is, I think, some pressure from the United States, chose to keep its forces in garrison and not challenge the Russian takeover. So I think the Russians are clearly in the wrong on this one. And I do believe it's appropriate for the West to continue to provide sanctions on Russia that are related to Crimea. although I have to say analytically it's very hard to see how Ukraine musters the political, diplomatic, and economic leverage to force Crimea's return. I think that's going to be a harder problem, which you need to set out to the future. And the priority now for Ukraine is trying to find a way to resolve the current conflict in Donbas and eastern Ukraine. I mean, Crimea was basically a bloodless operation. More than 10,000 people have died in the last 4 years in eastern Ukraine, and that's where the active war is still going on. And that should correctly be the Ukrainians' priority.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment and a question. I have a question as well. The comment is, I think one area of cooperation that's very valuable and important and ongoing between the U.S. and Russia is the Arctic. We, as a nation, are working closely with Russia in a multilateral area in the Arctic Council on things like security and search and rescue and environmental protection. Yeah. And then specifically between the U.S. and Alaska, there's still a lot of cooperation, which hopefully will continue, on shared species, managing and sharing information. And then the U.S. Coast Guard works with the Russian Border Guard very closely in the Bering Sea. So I think that's a really positive area of collaboration. And then my question was, you mentioned how economically Russia doesn't compare or stack up against Europe plus the U.S., but it seems Russia is opening its arms to China for economic development and various alliances. So I was wondering if you could speak about the China-Russia relationship.
Sure. Yeah, no, first of all, I agree with your point. It seems to me that the Arctic is, and it's one of those areas where U.S.-Russian cooperation makes sense, and I hope we're smart enough to figure out ways to do that, because I think that's in the interest of both countries. On the Russian-Chinese relationship, there's a lot going on there, but I tend to look at that as really a tactical arrangement. It's hard for me to see any kind of a strategic alliance between Moscow and Beijing, in part because, given the dynamics in China, Russia would be the junior partner. And I don't think the Kremlin ego could tolerate that. You also see some limits, too. I mean, it was interesting that in the aftermath of Russia's seizure of Crimea in 2014, and then the conflict in eastern Ukraine, and then the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner, you saw some fairly significant Western economic and commercial sanctions, including in the financial sector, applied against Russia, that made it much more difficult for Russian entities to borrow money in the West, and had a pretty significant impact on some Russian companies. One question we had was, will the Chinese step in to fill the gap? And by most appearances, the Chinese have been very leery about getting into that, in part because they look at this as a commercial arrangement. They're not sure whether it makes sense in commercial terms, but they're also concerned that, you know, if they begin lending now to Russian companies, do they then have their banks potentially become subject to Western sanction? So there have been some interesting areas where the Chinese have been, I think, rather conservative in how they deal with the Russians. Another example, and this goes back to, I think, 2015, when Russia and China signed an agreement. It's called, I think, the Energy of Siberia. It's a pipeline to bring Russian gas to China. The Chinese negotiated really hard, and I thought got very good terms, and basically have come up with an arrangement where most of the risk of building the pipeline, I mean, the Chinese attitude is basically, you guys build the pipeline, and if we need the gas, we'll buy it. So there are some certain things between Russia and China that I think we have to watch, but I think there are also some limitations on that relationship. And it's also, in China, they understand the economics. I mean, China still does trade with the United States that runs between $500 and $600 billion a year. The goal for Russian-Chinese trade in 2020 is about a fifth of that. And I think economics still figure in Chinese calculations.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My question is like this. Do you see an opportunity in the world in the near future to become sort of tripolar, where there's going to be the United States as one center of power, Russia is another one, and China is the third one? Because it seems like this is something that the Russian government is at least trying to be one of the poles of the power. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. No, I think we are probably moving, we're certainly moving away from the bipolar world that characterized the first 4 years after World War II. I mean, it's no longer this U.S.-Soviet competition that dominates everything. China, I believe, is emerging. You know, Europe, it's always been a question, can Europe get its act together and act in a more cohesive way politically. I think, as we see with Brexit, with Britain leaving the European Union, you know, that's not as easy as people might think. So we may be moving towards a world that is more multipolar. And I think there is a Russian calculation that in that kind of arrangement, it makes it more conducive to Russian influence and Russian power. We'll have to see.
Can you talk about or say a word about the change from McMaster to Bolton and implications of that?
Yeah. Oh, boy. That remains to be seen. The question was, what changes there might be from General McMaster to John Bolton as the National Security Advisor. Okay. I worked with Mr. Bolton for several years. I have to say I'm not his biggest fan. I guess it worries me a little bit because I think the president operates in a very impulsive way. He operates on instinct. And I think General McMaster had a system that was designed to try to channel that instinct and sometimes contain it. And for example, again, the policy that we have pursued over the last 15 months towards Russia, I think it's a fairly mainstream Republican policy. I'm not sure it's the policy that the president instinctively believes in. With Mr. Bolton, my guess is that you may have somebody who is more an enabler of the president's instincts, and I'm not sure that's always going to be a good thing. I do worry about Mr. Bolton. I think he downplays the possibility of diplomacy with states like North Korea and Iran. The Iran nuclear deal was not a perfect deal, but I think it was the best that we could get. I worry that if the United States leaves it, what we're going to do is have a situation where nobody else will reapply sanctions on Iran because the United States will be seen as the one to have left the agreement. And I fear that Mr. Bolton, in that case, may be an enabler of the president's instinct, which I think is incorrect. Likewise, on North Korea, I think it's interesting that the president has agreed to meet with the North Korean president. I think there are a lot of potential traps there, but it's better to have some kind of a conversation than proceed down a military path. I think Mr. Bolton is more inclined towards the military path, and it's hard for me to see any kind of military action against North Korea that doesn't end up with a huge military conflict which will cost thousands of American lives and tens of thousands of South Korean lives. So I worry about the instincts that Mr. Bolton's going to bring. I think Secretary Mattis, his job is going to become a lot more difficult now.
So one of the things that really surprised me after annexation of Crimea was why the rest of Europe, especially Germany, didn't take a more aggressive posture on economic sanctions against Russia. And I understand part of that has to do with business interests that those countries had with Russia and reluctant to put those at risk. But I also understand that there was, particularly in the case of Germany, some cultural affinity between Germans and Russians that made the country more reluctant to engage in this. And especially when you consider the history of recent decades, I find that especially surprising. So I'm wondering if you could address where that cultural affinity comes from.
Sure. Well, let me just start with the observation on, I actually think the European Union has done a pretty good job, in part led by German Chancellor Merkel, in terms of applying economic sanctions on Russia, particularly after the conflict began in Donbass, but also the shoot down of a Malaysian airline with a Russian-provided surface-to-air missile. And the kind of sanctions that I think back in early 2014, a lot of Americans would not have predicted, and would not have predicted that today in 2018, the European Union is still holding firm on those sanctions. Why it's harder for Europe to apply economic sanctions in the United States is pretty easy to understand. If you look at American trade with Russia, the last time I checked, Russia ranked about at the level of Costa Rica. European trade with Russia is about 10 times American trade with Russia. So when we're talking about economic sanctions and trade sanctions, we're talking about measures that are going to inflict a lot more economic pain on European companies than on American companies. So I think that's one of the reasons why the Europeans have been more reluctant. But as I said, I think most people who follow the situation have actually been impressed that Europe has sustained a fairly robust set of sanctions. Your point about Germany, I think, goes back to German war guilt. And I don't know, maybe Constanze might have mentioned this when she was here last year. This is my former colleague at Brookings. She's the German Bosch Fellow at Brookings. And she describes, I mean, there is a certain sense of the war guilt in Germany, you know, what the German military did to Russia. But I was at a talk once with Constanze, and she made the very eloquent point that just because my grandfather tried to kill Putin's grandfather does not give him a right then to occupy Crimea. And that's actually one thing I have a hard time understanding about the German cultural sensitivity towards Russia, because if you looked at what the German military did in Ukraine, it was every bit as bad as what they did to Russia. But somehow there is this war guilt that translates itself into some kind of a sensitivity towards Russia that when I talk to Ukrainians, they're frustrated. They said, well, wait a minute, you know, as many Ukrainians died on a proportionate basis as Russians, you know, why are we not getting some of that sensitivity as well?
Hello, sir. I wanted to ask you a question relating the Ukrainian conflict in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah.
It seems in recent years that the Ukrainian military has been rebuilding, and that involves like U.S. trainers and the western city of Yaroviv and whatnot. And as it doesn't seem that sanctions alone will force Russia out of Ukraine. Do you think there's a possibility for Ukraine to do what Croatia did in 1995 and try to militarily reclaim its territory from Russia? Or do you think that's not a likely possibility?
Yeah. Short answer is no. I just don't see any. I think the Ukrainian military today is significantly better than it was in 2014. Part of it is better resources now. They have better weapons. They're better trained. There are both Americans and also British troops that have been training the Ukrainians over the last 3 years. Although I think actually, when I talk to people at the Pentagon, they say that training is actually a two-way experience because we're actually, when the U.S. Army units go into Yavoriv, which is in western Ukraine, to train a Ukrainian unit, we're finding our units are learning a lot from the Ukrainians about current Russian tactics and equipment. But having said that, if you look at the size of the two countries, the size of the Ukrainian military compared to the Russian military, there's no way that the Ukrainian military is going to drive the Russians and the Russian proxy forces out of Donbass. And when you talk to senior Ukrainian military leaders, I think they understand that. Economic sanctions have, I think, had some impact. Economists say that they probably cost the Russian economy a 0.5% to 1% of gross domestic product every year, which in an economy that's only growing at about 1.5% a year is pretty significant. The sanctions have not yet succeeded in getting the Russians to say, okay, we're going to make peace in eastern Ukraine. And certainly they haven't succeeded in getting them to say, okay, we'll talk about giving Crimea back. But I wonder if the sanctions have kept the Russians from other steps that they might have taken. So, for example, in 2015, there was a lot of concern in Ukraine that the next Russian offensive would aim at the city of Mariupol. Mariupol is on the coast and the Sea of Azov. And if you have the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk, which are now occupied by Russian proxy forces, Mariupol is the logical third city because that's the way to export all of the heavy industry products. And the Russians didn't do it. And I wonder if that was because the Russians figured if we take Mariupol, then we can expect additional sanctions. And when you look at the scale of economic sanctions that have been applied on Russia, the Ambassador Dan Fried, who is the sanctions czar in the Obama administration, says on a scale of 1 to 10, he says, we're only about somewhere between 3 and 4 now. There's a lot more that we could do, you know, if we were prepared to be really nasty, that could be hugely disruptive to the Russian economy. And I think that potential to escalate the sanctions does have some impact on Russian actions.
Hi. Great talk. Thanks so much for coming. My question is related to the development of the Arctic from an economic opportunity standpoint, and how Russia, our relation with Russia, is going to affect the ability to collaborate with other Arctic nations and develop a sound, not only a policy for safety and for response to emergencies, but also for trade and for shipping and stuff like that, yeah. In addition to Russia's current claims to land in the Arctic as well.
I think the Russians have actually made a fairly expansive claim to the shelf north of Russia. The good news is they seem to be prepared to talk about it, so that there will be a multilateral discussion within a UN body on how far their claim can go. It's one where I worry a little bit that we will be a participant, but we, to some extent, America has a hand tied behind its back because we've never ratified the International Law of the Sea Convention. And that would give us certain rights to participate that we have denied to ourselves because of this. So at least the good news is the Russians appear to be prepared to talk about it. But when you look at the kind of lines that they would like to draw, they have pretty high ambitions about the shelf that they would like to take, in part because there's an expectation that there's a lot of oil and gas under that shelf.
So to kind of expand on that, though, less about the land claim, but more about a lot of the discussion was about the Ukraine and the imposition of sanctions and kind of the Western world imposing its will on Russian interests. But Russia has a huge interest in the Arctic and continuing to develop that area for economic opportunity. I was hoping that you could speak to what you see the future looking like.
Yeah. Well, I still think that in the Arctic, that is an area where there's a possibility for cooperation. And so where interests converge, cooperation makes sense. And I'm not talking about getting back to total business as usual, but I don't think we can tie up the entire relationship because of a dispute, say, for example, over Ukraine. Certainly, I would argue that the sanctions on Russia make sense that are related to Russian actions in the seizure of Crimea and also Russian continuing aggression in eastern Ukraine. But there are also some areas where, you know, we can have a more normal dialogue with the Russians. And the Arctic seems to be that kind of area to me.
Hi. So you mentioned that the U.S. needs to strengthen our communications with Russia and while drawing sort of stronger red lines. To what extent does that communication become more difficult when our response to Russian aggression is the expulsion of dozens of Russian diplomats? Does that sort of provide a hindrance for communication and dialogue?
Yeah, at one level it hurts, but at least as I understand it, we're talking about the expulsion. What I think may happen is you may see that these people are replaced. So it's going to be disruptive in the short term. But last summer, after the Russians expelled what amounted to about 60% of the Americans in the embassy in Moscow and then the consulates, and they said, okay, we're going to have an equal number of about 300 to 400 employees. So then that applies to American and Russian employees at the embassy and the consulates in Russia. It applies to Russian and American employees. The Russians tend not to use Americans in their diplomatic establishments. But they're not talking about lowering that ceiling. They're just talking about expelling 60 people. So that will come back. Now let me also make a point, too, is when I served at the embassy in Moscow, it was 1986 to 1988. We were busy expelling each other in great numbers. At the end of my, I'd been there for 5 months, and we had expelled 80 Soviets. They'd expelled only 10 Americans. But they had also withdrawn the 200 Russians who worked at the embassy. One result was that instead of doing my normal job all the time of being the guy in the embassy who followed arms control and security developments, about one day out of every seven I would be an embassy truck driver because we had to have somebody go pick up the diplomatic pouch and other things like that. But while we were having that very difficult time on the local level, you also had Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev meeting in Reykjavik and coming up with some really far-sighted proposals on arms control that resulted 2 years or a year later in the Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, and 4 years later on the first treaty that reduced strategic offensive nuclear forces. So sometimes you can have difficult relations in the expulsions, but it may not impact on the higher level. And we'll see how it plays out. I mean, certainly this is going to be disruptive in the short term. You know, but what we found back in 1986, 87, when we faced this, the embassy in Moscow, is Americans are pretty resilient and pretty creative, and they'll find ways to make this work. And I think that's going to happen with the people that are now at the embassy and the consulates in Russia.
Thank you, Mr. Pfeiffer, for coming here answering questions. My question is probably to the political technologies more than anything else, and especially Arctic being mentioned as a possible cooperation sooner or later, hopefully sooner than later. What happens to the round tables or any discussions or meetings between our leaders? Yep. And if in the last 5-10 years, and what must happen first before the round table or meetings will start or happen?
Now, this is one of the things that does worry me about the U.S.-Russia relationship is, you know, I would argue because of Russian actions in Ukraine, you know, it can't be business as usual. But that doesn't mean you shut down everything. So, for example, there really had been no focused arms control talks between Washington and Moscow for 6 years. Last September, we held one round of what was called the Strategic Stability Talks. And this is to talk about nuclear weapons issues and missile defense and all these questions. And that could be the basis to then to say, are there now some issues where maybe it's time to get into a more focused negotiation? We were supposed to have a second round in February. It was canceled. I would like to see the sides get back into and make that a regular dialogue, where we're doing those meetings every couple of months. Because that's a channel where, even if it doesn't produce a specific agreement, just having a conversation so we understand better the Russian concerns, they can understand our concerns. We may not believe their arguments, but at least we have better insights. I think that channel is something that we've lost that we could usefully restore. Likewise, some of the military-to-military context, there's now, unfortunately, a congressional prohibition on any cooperation in military-to-military channels. But can we have a dialogue between the American and the Russian militaries and say, okay, are there things that we could do that would reduce the risk that when you have a 27-year-old Russian pilot buzzing a ship commanded by a 36-year-old Navy captain, that those guys don't, you know, misinterpret it and react in a way that all of a sudden puts us in a situation that we don't want. So there was a concern about 3 months ago when a Russian fighter flew very close to an American intelligence aircraft. If there's a collision, what happens? I don't know, but I suspect it's not going to be good. The sides have an interest in basically setting some rules of the road so that certain things don't get out of hand. And I think those channels are missing now. I think to get to channels that would look at more cooperative elements, that's going to require first some changes in Russian behavior. And I think it goes back to Ukraine. My impression is that as long as there's a conflict in Ukraine, it's going to be hard to get back towards a more normal U.S.-Russia relationship. If the Russians were prepared to at least try to move towards a resolution of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, I think that would open up some possibilities. And this is one of the interesting things. I mean, despite all that's happened in the last 15 months, President Trump still seems to be hopeful of trying to get U.S.-Russia relations to a better place. Unfortunately, though, I'm not sure that the Russians are prepared to do the sorts of things that would allow us to proceed down that path. And that's why I argue why red lines make sense, because to the extent that we can indicate to the Russians that the current course is not going to allow them to achieve their objectives, maybe they rethink and we can get them on a different course which would allow some more cooperative talks.
Let's see. Does Russia have really a viable alternative to the port that they had in the Crimea?
Sevastopol, which was in Crimea, was the home port for the Russian Black Sea Fleet. But the problem the Russians have always had with the Black Sea is to get ships from the Black Sea to places outside of the Black Sea, you've got to pass through the Turkish Straits. And that was always pretty easy to shut down. So a lot of the, much more of the Russian naval assets are really in the North Fleet, which is based up near Murmansk on the Kola Peninsula, and the Baltic Fleet. So I think the Russian Navy's always understood that the Black Sea Fleet would have trouble getting outside of the Black Sea, whereas other ports, which have access not to warm water, but cold water, allowed easier access. No, actually, Crimea it doesn't really help the Russians export. In fact, one of the problems the Russians found was when they seized Crimea, the Ukrainians imposed a de facto economic blockade on Crimea. And all of a sudden, in Crimea, economics became very difficult because they had no connection to Russian proper. There's now under construction a bridge across the Kerch Strait, which would link Crimea directly to the Russian mainland. And that will enable some things. You know, but right now, if you're looking to export from Russia, Crimea is not a solution because you can't get things to Crimea.
One thing I noticed about the Russian approach to Ukraine is that it seems like Russians, you know how you said that Russia does not want to recreate the Soviet Union?
Yeah.
But I think in relation to Ukraine, it's a little different because Russians, for the most part, don't even consider Ukrainians as a separate nation.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they say they're either like Russians with a bad Polish accent or something like Russians manipulated by Westerners or something. Yeah. So, because they consider like Kyiv the mother of all Russian cities and all these other historical cultural claims. And I think as long as that kind of understanding permeates in the Russian society, I don't see how like there's ever going to be a time where Russia will legitimately respect Ukraine's borders or Ukraine's like identity as Ukrainians themselves.
No, I think that's a fair point. A lot of Russians still refer to Ukrainians as little Russians. I mean, Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire from 1654 up until 1991, with the exception of about 3 years after World War I when things were very fluid. And I remember a conversation with a Russian deputy foreign minister back in 1994 where he said, look, up here I understand that Ukraine's an independent country. Here it's going to take a little bit longer. And of all of the republics that Russia lost when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine is the one that matters the most. Now, having said that, I think one of the unintended consequences of Russian policy towards Ukraine over the last 4 years has been to utterly poison that relationship. When I served in Ukraine at the end of the 1990s, I would say that in Western Ukraine, there was some very strong Ukrainian nationalists who were very strongly anti-Russian, but that was a very small percentage of the total population. A lot of the population wanted to be friendly with Russia. They had neighbors or relatives in Russia. A lot of Ukrainians spoke Russian as their first language. And so I didn't detect a lot of societal animus against Russia in the late 1990s. I think that's different now. After the seizure of Crimea and the outbreak of fighting in eastern Ukraine, I was visiting Kyiv, and a longtime Ukrainian contact to me said, you know, Vladimir Putin has succeeded where centuries of Ukrainian nationalists have failed. Putin has built a Ukrainian sense of national identity, and he's imbued it with a strong anti-Russian sense. And you see it in polls. I mean, polls where Ukrainians are asked, what are your feelings towards Russia? And the levels of hostility are orders of magnitude beyond what they were 15 years ago. Because many Ukrainians say, you know, Russia took Ukrainian territory in Crimea. Russia is killing Ukrainians in Donbass. And every week, three or four Ukrainian soldiers die. And I'm not sure the Kremlin understands just how badly they poisoned that relationship. Another aspect that you've seen is that you now have in polls, maybe not yet a majority, you know, but large numbers saying they would like to see Ukraine in NATO. Russian policy of the last 4 years has had the effect of pushing Ukrainian society to want to join Europe and embed itself in Europe and get away from Russia. And I think it's going to take years or decades to change that.
In your formula for improving relations with Russia, you left something out that maybe you did intentionally, citizen diplomacy. What role do you see for student exchanges, Rotary Club, pilgrims, that sort of thing, going back and forth and supporting this effort and improving dialogue?
Yeah. No, I'm a big fan of those kinds of people-to-people exchanges. And actually, I'll throw out an example. When I was at the National Security Council in the 1990s, my boss was a professor at Stanford. And when he went back to Stanford, I moved up and became senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. And it was in 1997, he came up to Anchorage, I think, to talk to the World Affairs Council. And he called me and he said, you know, Steve, you would have no idea how much is going on between Alaska and the Russian Far East. All of these exchanges going on, commercial contacts, people-to-people exchanges. And my reaction was, that's great. I want to see a normal U.S.-Russia relationship where it's not a big deal for the federal government that these things are expanding. We don't want to be able to track all these things. So I'm a big fan of that. Unfortunately, it's become harder now. I mean, we have certain programs that we ran in Russia designed to bring Russian high school kids to the United States for a year in American high school. The Russians have canceled those programs. They've shut those programs down. They shut down the Peace Corps. They've shut down other efforts that we've run to promote citizen-citizen exchanges. So it's become a lot harder. But I think having those contacts is still important because especially now when the official contacts are more difficult. But unfortunately, we're in a situation where the possibilities that we had, say, 10 years ago, where I think we were bringing several hundred high school students a year to the United States. And that experience, I think, changes kids in a real way, and then sending American kids there. The Russians, unfortunately, are moving towards a degree of self-isolation and have severed those programs.
I'm hoping Vic Fisher will say something here, too. I'm excited to introduce you to him. He's sitting over here.
Hi, I just have a question about Russian society. I just kind of noticed in recent years, as far as like the democratization of Russia, like they've had democratic movements within Russia that are more like pro-Western stuff, but it seems like that's hard to happen there, like especially after the assassination of Boris Nemtsov and other Russian pro-Western, pro-democracy leaders. Do you think, is there a chance for something like the Maidan or some kind of democratic uprising in Russia can happen, seeing as the latest election results don't look so well for that kind of situation to happen? Is there a possibility for that?
I don't totally exclude it, but I don't expect it. And I think this is actually a big difference between Russia and Ukraine. In 2011, there was the Volotnaya demonstration, which attracted, I think, 90 or 100,000 people in Moscow. And that was a big deal for Moscow. But Moscow is a city of about 15 million people. Compare that to the Maidan demonstrations, where in a city of less than 3 million people, you had 500,000 people on the streets. And I think this has been a problem. One of the things that makes me optimistic and hopeful about Ukraine, although Ukraine has not made the progress I would like to have seen Ukraine make, is that I think there is this bottom-up push for democracy, for human rights, for a robust civil society. I don't see it at that level in Russia. And I remember actually one of my last visits to Moscow when I was still a U.S. government official in 2004, and I met with the Moscow-Helsinki Commission. And these are people, several of these people spent years in the gulag. And I made the point, I said, I don't understand. I don't see a bottom-up push here in Russia for more democracy. And they sort of agreed. And I said, well, what will lead to that? And they said, well, we think that the economic circumstances have to improve to the point where people are not so focused on their day-to-day situation, where they can say, okay, now maybe I can agitate for more political rights and such. But I think there's a huge difference between Russia and Ukraine in that sense.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
Thank you, Ambassador, for coming. I haven't noticed much in the last couple of years in the news about the Russians being either willing or able to intimidate and control Western Europe through the use or cutting off the natural resources. I remember that happened, I don't remember how many years ago, maybe 2014-ish, when they were threatening the natural gas pipeline transfers over to Europe. So what has happened in that arena? Is it that the Europeans have been successful at providing other resources, that they're no longer a threat, that the Russians have backed off on that particular type of threat? I'm just wondering what's going on in that arena.
Yeah, this has been a big issue. Europe probably imports about 25 to 30% of its natural gas from Russia. A lot of it comes from pipelines that flow through Ukraine. There's the Nord Stream pipeline, which flows under the Baltic Sea from Russia directly to Germany. And there was a lot of concern that would the Russians be able to use this for political leverage? Now, it's interesting. If over the last 25 years, there are a number of instances where you could say the Russians made political use of the gas weapon and threatened to shut the gas off to the Baltic states, to Ukraine, to Georgia, they've never really made that overt threat to Europe. And I think that's because there's a certain mutual aspect to the relationship, is that Europe needs the gas from Russia, but Gazprom, which is the large Russian entity that exports the gas, derives something like 65% of its revenue from gas exports to Europe. Now, what you have seen over the last 3 or 4 years, and this was driven by gas disputes between Russia and Ukraine in 2006 and then again in 2009. And basically, there was no contract. The Russians said, well, we're going to turn off the gas to Ukraine, but we'll continue to ship the gas through Ukraine that goes to Europe. Funny thing happened. That gas didn't come out to Europe. The Ukrainians just took that gas. And so the only way that the Russians had of shutting off all the gas to Ukraine was to shut the gas off to Europe as well. And the Europeans, I think, took notice of that. And what you've seen over the last 5 or 6 years is construction in Western Europe of facilities to receive liquefied natural gas. Now, part of that is there's a lot of there's more LNG on the market because in the Middle East back in the early 2000s, they built a lot of LNG export capacity because everyone thought America's going to need to import LNG in 2015, and then we went and discovered unconventional natural gas, and we don't need it. So what the Europeans have done is they built the facilities to receive liquefied natural gas. They still prefer the Russian gas because the gas that comes by pipeline is cheaper. But I think for most of Europe, not all of Europe, I think Greece, Romania, Bulgaria would be in a difficult straits. But for a lot of Europe, if the Russians turned off the gas, at greater cost, Europe would be able to still bring the gas in using LNG. So I think that situation, we can ask whether it makes sense for Europe to buy more Russian gas, which sort of enables bad Russian behavior. But I'm not sure we're in a situation where the threat of a Russian gas cutoff would have the political impact that we might have feared 10 years ago. And to my mind, that's a positive development.
I'm sorry, I had to slip out, and so maybe you've already answered this, but you didn't actually talk very much in your presentation about whether you think that the Russian intervention in foreign elections is actually something that they're going to carry on, bearing in mind that there's so much coverage of it, or do you think they might diminish that now?
I fear they're going to carry it on. I think that there was some evidence that they tried to do it in European elections last year. And if you're in Moscow, well, I'm not sure what the expectations that they had for the interference. But I have to think that you're in Moscow looking at the effect, it's actually been pretty good. I mean, look at how, I mean, you know, Washington is to some extent paralyzed on a lot of these questions. And it's, I think, caused an inward-looking focus that has made America a less active foreign policy player. So from the Russian perspective, I think that's a win. And this is where I would fault both the Obama administration and the Trump administration is we have not imposed penalties in terms of, you know, economic or visa sanctions to make clear that, no, this is an unacceptable action and that there will be punishment. So if you're in Moscow looking at the benefits and the costs, you're saying, why not try it again? And I worry about, I think you are continuing to see it. People who are a lot smarter, for example, about Twitter than I am, they're looking and saying, if you look at certain bot accounts, how they are still targeting to try to, you know, drive differences. And so my guess is we're going to see some of this in 2018, and we may see this in some of this in 2020. I mean, this is a case to me where, you know, we have to make sure to the Russians that this is, our democratic system is sort of the heart of how America works. We should not be prepared to tolerate other countries interfering in that. And we should be prepared to inflict fairly substantial penalties, and, you know, economic sanctions, things like that, to signal that that kind of behavior is unacceptable. If we don't, we should not be surprised that the Russians continue to do it.
Okay, and I'd like to close up and hand the microphone over to Vic Fisher, who is one of the gentlemen who's founded our Constitution for Alaska, spent his early years in Moscow. His father is a famous American journalist. And there's a wonderful book on his life, To Russia with Love, which I can't recommend enough. Vic Fisher.
I just want to thank you for probably the best presentation on U.S., Russia, a Russia-world relationships. I think your explanation of Russian attitudes toward Ukraine, Ukrainians' attitudes toward Crimea, and all the general aspects and the specific explanations you gave are invaluable and, from my standpoint, 100% correct. So, as someone who's been in through that from childhood, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vic.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've just heard from Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council on March 30th. This was an edited version of his presentation. You can hear a longer version by visiting the Addressing Alaskans page at alaskapublic.org. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.